Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined as usual by the one and only Jin Yumi, sometimes also known as Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danwei.com, the Financial Times company. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm very, very well. When are you going to get sick of that?
I'm not. It's fun to say every time. So we started this podcast, man, 3 years ago now. It was April 1st, 2010. That was our first podcast. So our very first topic.
A fitting date.
Yes, indeed. April Fools. Our very first topic was Google's decision to refuse to censor and the resultant partial withdrawal from China. I always like saying partial withdrawal. Since then, it's been a rare week on Cynica that we haven't in some capacity spoken of the internet. In fact, we've done it sort of to a fault, right? We sometimes get a little criticism for being too internet-y. But, you know, given what...
But that's fairly natural, given what we do.
Yeah. So, you know, we talk about netizen reaction, basically, to whatever story or stories we're discussing for the week. Sometimes we've spoken of it, you know, very directly. Other times it's just sort of an incidental reference to it. But today we are going to focus very deliberately on the big questions around the internet in China. And with us to discuss it is Gadi Epstein, whose newspaper The Economist has just published a 14-page special section about China and the internet, which I plugged on last week's show and which I cannot help but refer to as Gadi's enormous package. Hello, Gadi.
Thank you so much, Kaiser. Always good to be here, as I was very shortly after your first show.
Yes, you were. Indeed, you were. Gadi's been a stalwart ever since. Thus his Homeric epithet.
And it must have been that Baidu listened to your first show about Google's partial withdrawal from China and just thought, this is a guy who has to work for us.
You know, I doubt they've listened to it, but hey, whatever. I'm actually kind of hoping they don't. But anyway, it is true that I did take the job at Baidu shortly after we launched Cynica on its maiden voyage. So let me say that I plugged this special report last time on I hadn't read it yet, right? I mean, I admitted as much, but I had trusted.
Big leap of faith.
I trusted that you were going to do the topic justice in both your reporting and in your analysis, which is ever insightful. I have to say, actually, if anything, it exceeded my expectations.
Thank you, thank you.
And in fact, I mean, it's quite, you know, it's been talked about quite a bit. I think that for years to come, people are going to make this sort of the reference. You know, before you ask me another question about the internet, read Gadi Epstein's package.
I appreciate
Check
that.
Check out his package. it's really the most comprehensive. Jeremy, you would agree. It's like the most comprehensive thing.
Yeah, no, it's excellent. Yeah. It's a very comprehensive review of all kinds of issues on the Chinese internet.
And yet does not cover everything. But I did what I can in 14 pages.
Know. Yeah, well,
it's
we'll
like
see.
The elephant, right?
Right, the always yeah. the elephant.
The always referred to elephant with the blind man each right. feeling a different part. I mean, exactly. How do you describe the whole internet?
We'll see which parts you left off. And I mean, you can talk about some of the cutting room floor sweepings as well.
Right.
But I mean, what was important to me is that you really captured the contradictions, I mean, you know, the paradoxical truths of it, you know, being at once sort of a de facto public sphere and occasion. And the metaphor you used, I thought, was quite good. Anyway,
thank you.
It's also important to me that you took the air out of that whole techno-utopian fantasy that
right.
Irks me. So I guess some of our readers would probably want to know, I mean, we don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but, you know, how something like this comes about. I mean, what is involved in a special section? You know, how long did you have to work on it, for example?
So special reports are kind of they're a thing where you have to pitch once a year. Everybody on the staff, editors, correspondents, London and far flung, pitch to a special reports editor.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of report they want to do, because you're going to get 5 weeks off from your beat to do it. In addition to whatever other time you can work around that, and you get your name on it as you know, you get a byline, which is the one time you get to do that in The Economist.
So you let your colleagues carry you for the last 5 weeks,
right? So they carry you for 5 weeks, and then you get your name on this report.
Wow, good deal, man.
Yeah, and so
and then are you allowed to turn it into a book after that?
I think they do. They definitely have released some as I don't know if they do it every time. But they release some as Kindle singles.
Oh.
And of course, if I wanted to pursue it as a longer form book, I'd be free to do that.
Yeah.
Cool. So you pitch those and then you find out. And the year runs, the year of special reports, they run one, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks. And they run from April 1st. So this was actually the first of the new year of special reports. And I was told around Christmas that I was going to be first up, which meant that I wasn't going to get much time outside of my allotted 5 weeks.
But you were going to get a byline,
right?
Which is such a rare thing.
But it did change the nature of my Christmas vacation a bit as I started to obsess about this topic.
But you're Jewish. So. And you live in China, so what are you complaining about?
Well, there was an actual holiday involved there.
Right. We ruined your Hanukkah.
Although it's
Brady Einstein. Yeah.
But because I'm from Silicon Valley, raised in Palo Alto, not born there. I actually was there where I did some of my reporting to start with, and as it happened, there were some interesting people there who were going to help me think about the Chinese internet.
Cool. So I mean, as you thought about it, I mean, as you approached this, were there some popular misconceptions, wrong ideas about the Chinese internet that were sort of rampant among or prevalent among Chinese the economists' readers? That you set out to overthrow or to challenge at least?
Well, I think my main goal was I don't think that a lot of people think too deeply in their daily lives about what the Chinese internet is like. They might not know, as you've talked about in your own talks, how vibrant a space it is for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
They also might not know kind of how censorship is very fine-tuned here.
Mm-hmm.
They just might have a general sense, if they even have one, that there is the Great Firewall. And that there is censorship. But I don't think there's too much deep thought about how very different it is. And one thing I'd set out to do was, if we were to write about the internet in any other country, you would just write about the business of the internet there.
Right.
But China, more than any other country, has worked very hard to make its internet different and special. And that's what I wanted to write about, was that they had done something
The Great Firewall? This is the most successful brand that China has ever launched.
And it wasn't even, it's not, of course, not a name that they create.
Right. You can actually see it from cyberspace.
Right.
The name actually was created, as I've pointed out a few times, by Sang Ye and Jeremy Barme,
right.
Who happened to be friends of mine.
I'd like to know exactly who was the person.
1997,
I've read the article. The article is called The Great Firewall of China, although, right. You know, that phrase is not in the article itself. So it might be a headline writer at Wired. What he uses, what Jeremy and his colleague used in that article, was netwall, I believe.
Really?
If you actually read the article itself.
No, he's going around taking credit for it, definitely. So
He may have written the headline too.
I think they did. I'm pretty sure they did.
But anyways, that was the first mention I've ever seen of it, and it's an interesting article. Although it's not really referring either to the Great Firewall, it's referring to some early efforts by police to do filtering.
I think what it is that they identified right from the very beginning that the Chinese internet was going to have Chinese characteristics.
Right, they did.
And
it was
that's
very smart.
Point, right?
It was a very smart article in that way.
But let's move on to your article. So what is in your article? I think you should run us through the different sections because it's a bit of an octopus. It's got several,
is that,
many legs.
Octo, is that the right?
It's an onopus. There's nine articles.
Oh, right.
Somehow that doesn't sound right. But anyway, go ahead.
No, it doesn't. The first article, just introing the whole package, as you like to put it, Kaiser, is the headline of the piece as well, A Giant Cage, where I just describe where I lay out what I'm going to be writing about, and that the government here has and the party have worked to make the internet different.
Mm-hmm.
I go a little bit into the history there, talking about President Clinton, talking a famous quote that you can't nail jello to the wall. This, attempts to control the internet would fail, and how China has worked very hard to confound that logic. I also talk about the very first email sent from China, which was sent in 1987, if my memory serves correctly.
It's like, fuck y'all, we're going to block this shit.
Which was about, we can reach out
across the Great
Wall.
To
reach to every corner of the world, which was, I think, quite a...
Sent from a very cute scientist in Beijing.
Right, a delightful phrase.
To Switzerland, I think.
To Germany.
To Germany, yeah.
So,
cute, what do you mean? How cute?
Like, cute as in, what
cutely,
a sweet little
phrased.
Sentiment. Cutely cute,
Right. And so then I go on to talk about the history of internet controls and how it works today.
Mm-hmm.
Not just controls, but also using the internet as a listening post, Weibo and blogs, etc. The the expansion, the explosion of the online public opinion monitoring business.
Right.
Tons of local governments around China buying these online public opinion monitoring software services and hardware packages that can include filtering tools or tools to help you speed up the process of getting something blocked. But the main purpose of which I think for many of them is to sort of just figure out if there's any trouble spots coming.
Mm-hmm. Sentiment monitoring. It's a common thing.
I mean, actually, one of the this is not specifically in the piece, but one of the most successful of them is Zhu Huaxin's shop over at People's Daily Online. They're very good at this, and they started it right around the train crash.
A good time to do it in
2011. They've done some very interesting work on this, but they're not exactly very public about it. They do internal reference reports within the party.
Okay,
opinion monitoring. This is throughout the system, and it's an important part of it. But I also go into the history of the different forms of censorship, and then lead to you're talking about Golden Shield and the Great Firewall. Which, if you're talking about misconceptions, people who even know a lot about the Chinese internet will confuse those two quite often, and to the consternation of internet experts, they meld these two projects. Which the Golden Shield is Ministry of Public Security. It's sort of what watches over the domestic internet. What some people would call net nanny, although I don't think that's quite.
I think it's your coinage, right, Jeremy?
I don't think
the cyber nanny.
Net nanny. I don't know if it's my coinage. It's one that we used to use a lot on Danway to.
I don't think it quite gets at it. There is a law enforcement component to Golden Shield.
The Golden Shield project. The Great Firewall.
Great Firewall doesn't have a law enforcement component.
Right. That's just a system of filters at the ISP level, right?
And it does it at these international gateways.
Exactly.
And the Great Firewall. And one thing that was surprising to me was that the Great Firewall. We don't know how much it costs. The details are state secrets, but we have guesses that are out there about how much it costs, and it probably costs an order of magnitude less than Golden Shield. And it may have cost so far about $160 million, about a billion RMB.
Do we still use Golden Shield as
one thing, Gadi, yes, sort of not to give you pushback, but to just question, is Golden Shield was a word that used to be used. I guess I first heard it maybe as much as 10 years ago. And at the time, it was all the police activities on the internet, plus the police, because the police in China have their own intranet. So like when you, as a foreigner, say, or any Chinese person, when you go to a hotel and you give them your ID, and then the hotel has to give that information to the local police department, and they log it on a computer.
That's part
of Golden Shield. So if I want to know, like if you go to a business trip to Shanghai and I'm a policeman, I could find that out by going onto the police intranet.
Well, the reason
which used to be called Golden Shield, but I don't know. Call that Golden Shield. Isn't that just the police intranet?
My understanding was that Golden Shield was the all-encompassing term for the entire system.
Cybersecurity apparatus.
Right.
Generally.
No, well, Golden Shield is an official name, and it does apply to more than just the police internet you're describing. There's a number of different projects, and there's funding sources for Golden Shield projects beyond just the central government level. It's much more than what you're describing. And it's one of the reasons that it's much more expensive overall. I mean, at least 10 billion RMB is because it's more diffuse and it tries to do a lot more than what the Great Firewall is doing.
Okay, but let's move on. What's the next section of? I mean, we're doing the nanopus here. What's
the nanopus?
Right. Well,
yeah. So the next one after
the thread here.
So then we do the Great Firewall itself with Fang Bingxing and the whole
let's explain who Fang Bingxing is for people who don't know. He's known as the father of the Great Firewall. He's at the University of Post and Telecommunications. He's a professor there, widely vilified.
Right. So a vilified figure on the Chinese internet, and I wanted to write about how even he has become a sensitive keyword.
And I think you mentioned also in the package that he's so vilified that he can't actually have open comments on his microblog Weibo account because there are too many people cuss him out.
Right. So his microblog account doesn't have open comments, and And he also does not, as you can imagine, give many interviews. I don't know of any interviews he's given to foreign press.
There isn't a similar figure, though, for the Golden Shield, for domestic internet censorship, right? I mean, there isn't somebody who is blamed for that whole apparatus.
There's no one.
Why is that? When, to my mind, it seems that,
I think that's because Great Firewall has become the catch-all for all of that.
Right.
And also some of the research that Fang Bingqing does is applied domestically. You know, he has said that he has written that some of his work on keyword filtration
right.
is used by domestic internet companies, perhaps including yours, Kaiser. We don't know the details of that. He's just said
nor
that.
Do I,
he's said that generally. So I think it's pretty fair to kind of put a lot of it at his feet. And he's been involved in it since at least when he joined the former MIIT, MII, in 1999 to start working on the Great Firewall, which, of course, didn't have that name but has been given to them.
Christened. Oh, and what's the next section then?
Next one is after Great Firewall, I think is the e-commerce section. Let me look at my list here.
A little bit of a departure then from...
Oh, no. Right after that is the piece I did on Panxi
and Weibo. Great.
Which was also it was great to get Panxi, who does not give a lot of interviews to foreign press.
Let's explain who Panxi is for those of you who don't know.
So he's the founder chairman of Soho China, and along with Jiang Xin, the CEO, billionaires.
Real estate
billionaires, and Panxi is a real figure on the Chinese internet, dating back to days of blogs and bulletin boards. He's been very active. And he was invited by Sina when they started Weibo,
which was in the year 2009, right?
To be one of the original like 20 accounts, and so he has 15 million followers.
And why is he so popular? I mean, let's give people a sense of that. I mean, contrast him with his wife, Zhang Xin, who's equally well known, is. A very sophisticated cosmopolitan. I mean, she speaks really, really excellent English. She was Oxbridge. I can't remember which.
Cambridge, I think.
Cambridge, okay, sure.
I'm not sure, though.
Really remember. Elegant, really, you know, nattily attired, you know, great sartorial sense. And her husband?
Well, yeah, her husband's earthy.
Earthy, salt of the earth.
Yeah, salt of the earth. He's
from Ningxia, right? Or Gansu, one of the two.
His first barrel of gold, as they say, from Hainan property speculation. He's really kind of an original real estate baron. And then he met Jiang Xin. They started Soho China in Beijing in the 90s. He wouldn't be popular, I think, if he was just stayed a real estate mogul. I mean, most real estate moguls are not well-liked
right.
here, being considered to have helped kick people off their land to get and gotten sweetheart deals with officials for their land. But he has very effectively used the internet as a platform for, you know, kind of interesting commentaries. He seems pretty candid. He sometimes takes on political issues.
And I mean, I think even more than that, he was one of the first people to see the possibilities of blogs and social media.
Very much so.
So one of the best forum websites in, say, 2006 was Soho Xiaobao. And there was an associated print magazine, which published really interesting commentaries from marginal characters and progressive types and not dissidents, but people who were not establishment figures.
Sure.
So, I mean, he has some street cred. He's not just a wanky right. real estate guy.
No, he's definitely, I mean.
And when he has been taken on, including the Weibo era, he's shown a sense of humor and not taken to, like, you know, for the whole thing about the pan.
Let's explain that story. I know what you're referring to.
Yeah.
So on the day that Steve Jobs died, he put up a post that said, you know, Steve Jobs would have really sealed his immortality if he had been able to offer an iPhone for 1,000 yuan. And people immediately, you know, jumped on and started ridiculing him and saying, well, where's our, you know, 1,000 per square meter housing, you know, 1,000 yuan per square meter housing. That became a unit of measure, the pan, right?
Right.
The pan yuan.
Pan yuan. And he, you know, tweeted a photo of it. I mean, he owned the joke. He was the target of a joke, and then he took
right,
it on.
He owned it.
So he's a very savvy user.
Absolutely.
And And then, you know, this pollution issue came up. And he actually doesn't take on extremely controversial issues on Weibo normally. But this is one where, as you talked with me about, you know, it affects his own kids. But he also knew that it affects, you know, the leaders have to breathe this air. I mean, when they're not in, you know, their air purified offices, that, you know, the media figures here, the heads of the state-owned companies, they're all in Beijing.
And Mike Forsyth tweeted earlier today, right, a picture of a
IQ air delivery outside truck. The foreign ministry.
Right.
So he knew that, and he realized this was an area that he could actually comment on. He was quite candid. He said, look, there's a lot of things I can't really talk about. And he kind of listed some of them. And I thought maybe even more broadly than is maybe the case.
Uh-huh.
But on air pollution, he felt, I can take this on. And he just started, he thought as a simple thing, tweeting the PM2.5, the particulates that are small enough to get into your lungs that can do the most damage.
Your bloodstream, right.
Tweeting the U.S. Embassy's Twitter stream that was announcing those figures long before, of course, China was doing that itself. And he just started building up attention for this, and it was really kind of one of the first ways that the Chinese public was getting educated about this. And he would, you know, did an online poll asking for, whether people should when Beijing should have a standard for PM2.5. He was called in by, Beijing officials saying, you know, we can't even have that in 10 years. What are you talking about? You know, he would ask, you know, 1 year, 5 years, or we don't need one. Of course, everybody said, we need one in 1 year.
In 1 year, right.
But anyways, within less than a year, there was a PM2.5 standard for Beijing. And not long after that, they were issuing their own PM2.5 readings. And then by January 1st, another 70-plus cities were doing it. January 1st of this year, were doing their 2.5 readings. And then we had airpocalypse in January, just horrible air all over China. And what was one of my favorite charts in the report is just the percentage of users that tweeted the words PM2.5 or smog in all these cities. And in Beijing, actually, it's a relatively low number because I think they're so used to it.
Right.
But in places like Hangzhou and Shanghai, it was extremely
off the charts,
high.
Yeah. It's huge.
So anyways, it was Panxi was really eloquent in talking about this stuff. We talked for more than an hour for the story, and I was glad to have that opportunity.
Yeah, now you don't have to read it. So the next one was the Alibaba or
the
e-commerce story.
The e-commerce story. Yes. Well, you mentioned Alibaba. So my colleague Vijay Vaidaswaran did a cover story on Alibaba a couple of weeks ago, which was your classic kind of story about, you know, the way that the internet is making e-commerce. making e-commerce it's an e-commerce boom story. You know, which is classic China story. And I wanted to. I had set out to do something different about how China has made its internet different, and so I took on the example of online gaming,
right?
Which had initially started with imported games here. I mean, very popular imported games from Korea, Japan, the United States, eventually they saw that this was becoming a big market, and also a market where the stories being told were not Chinese stories in mm-hmm, these games, mm-hmm. Through various practices, they made the game market in China a much more Chinese market. And the way they did that, I thought, was very telling. And so that was what that part is about. And I talked to Kai-Fu Lee for that section, and we had a good talk about innovation, which is one of his favorite topics.
Right.
Because what I kind of conclude is that this way of running an internet, and this is not a controversial conclusion for anyone who's looked at the Chinese internet market, is not a way that will produce innovation. It may produce process innovation, but it's not the way that it'll encourage leaps of innovation that produce the next Steve Jobs.
Right. I personally think that we're held back by more prosaic reasons.
Well, the education system. There's a lot of stuff.
No, I mean, it's not even that. I think that it's just a whole lot of low-hanging fruit. You get your 3 minutes.
That is part of it. Yeah,
right.
But I mean, I think if you were forced to compete more on a more level playing field with foreign players, that would also probably force you to be more competitive.
In terms of
innovation. Right. So that's interesting. Yeah, but you're right. There's tons of companies to clone still out there, and right. That you can just make a lot of money right away. And I mentioned Wang Xing in that story. He's someone I wrote about for Forbes.
Wang Xing's a really interesting character.
Yeah. So he's extremely smart Tsinghua engineer, Tsinghua graduate, who who has cloned Friendster, which didn't work out, but he was the first Facebook clone, right. Successful Facebook clone with RenRen, which he sold too early but made a few million dollars out
yeah,
of.
Yeah, like $5 million, I understand.
And then he yeah,
back too
then.
Early.
right.
Money.
I think
yeah. Dr. Evil.
I think
$5 million.
Right, and then he cloned Twitter with right. Fanfo, and I didn't have room to get into this in
then
the piece,
Groupon.
But but Fanfo ran into problems because of censorship.
What happened in 2009? Right,
he didn't censor it well enough when Tiananmen and when the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen
was it that
happened.
Or was it July? Was it,
no,
was
it June.
Xinjiang?
It was both. I mean, it was.
He didn't
his
die
trouble,
until Xinjiang, right?
His trouble started with June. Okay. June 4th.
And that was that was when Danway.org got blocked, which was obviously the major internet event in
China. Right, it was.
But
the big story of 2009.
So it was a, you know, June, July,
much bigger
August
than the shutdown of the Xinjiang internet. Right?
Yeah, much bigger. That was a sensitive period.
So then Fanfo got shut down for a very long time and basically lost the battle.
Died.
To become,
yeah, it died.
No, it came back.
It did come back.
Yeah,
but
died.
But it basically
it
died as a business proposition.
It was dead.
Right. Came back with 56 came back. Right?
Yeah.
I do have friends who use Fanfo.
It's dead.
But and 56 is another one. 56 Shutdown was another one that I didn't get into. It's an online video site that was shut down also for
7 weeks.
Running afoul.
Right, for 7 weeks.
And that's one of those issues where this is another thing you can't, you know, didn't have space to get into. But you sometimes, certainly the people involved in 56 wondered whether it was just a matter of, you know, they don't have the right. You know, their competitors have the right connections to take advantage of the fact that maybe you weren't aggressive enough with your
I don't think that was
self-monitoring.
That's their conspiracy.
No,
that wasn't the case, though.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah.
But it does create.
They just fucked up in a huge way.
It does create openings. You know, the system creates openings for that kind of, at least, thinking.
Right.
And then Wang Xing made a Groupon clone, the most successful one,
right.
One of the most successful ones, Meituan. So he's doing very well with that.
So Meituan is one of the few left standing right now.
But these are pretty much exact copies.
Right.
You know? And I asked him, why do you just do exact copies of these interfaces and et cetera? And he was like, they're good. You know, the originals are good, basically. You know, and I'm more focused on making it work as a product for the customer.
Right.
Anyways, it's not a system that encourages a lot of innovation. And even Kai-Fu Lee, who I think really talks persuasively about innovation, you know, his fund is invested in some clones.
I mean, he's quote Clora, so, cloned Quora. He's cloned
Tumblr, I believe, too.
Yeah, Tumblr.
Closed Clora.
What was that? And
cloned Quora. Say that 10 times fast.
Cloned Quora.
And he has some jealous fellow funders out there who call him the king of clones.
Right.
So that's the e-commerce section. And then the next one was, I think, about the rest of the world, right? Let's see. The rest one right after that is hacking. I lead from talking about Google at the end of the e-commerce piece.
Because
Google's with partial withdrawal, as you put it, right. A withdrawal of their search mainland-based search service.
As you more elegantly put
it. Was triggered in the end by
hacking attacks.
Hacking attacks.
Right. Operation Aurora, as they called it.
And so the hacking article was actually one that I felt, while needed to be done, was to me less interesting than some of the other parts of the report. I'm still interested in it, but I read a ton of these kind of security reports about hacking and talked to some. And it's a very interesting field. And what was interesting to me about it was that the hacking is not necessarily all that sophisticated, and they get caught so often.
Right.
Pretty much,
they don't seem to care. That was,
and,
I thought,
and that they don't care.
Interesting.
So that's what was interesting to me about it. The kind of once again the political aspect of it.
Because there's no downside, or there hadn't been to date.
And I think there's still there really hasn't still been a political downside for them. But we'll see whether that maintains. So I talked to Wan Tao, who has been interviewed in a few.
So the next section then, after the hacking one, we've got to roll through these.
Okay. Sorry, I paused there because Kaiser was giving me a symbol there. Let's see here. The next one was internet controls in other countries, to each their own.
Right.
I just wanted to talk about how this kind of model of not only controls but also having, paid commentators or influencing bloggers and filtering. These things happen in a number of other authoritarian states.
There's like 50 ruble party.
And the 50 what?
Ruble party.
The 50 ruble party. Well, I don't know if there is a 50 ruble party. But
What's the currency in Kazakhstan? You went there actually to do some reporting.
Oh, obviously, the currency in Kazakhstan is obviously to Kugulili. I did go to Kazakhstan for several days for this story, and I think you'll see a couple sentences about Kazakhstan as a result of all that. But
money well spent.
but it was another. It was an interesting. Kazakhstan takes as many lessons from Russia as well, but China's. Chinese presence there is felt, and Huawei and ZTE, for instance, are much used products by their internet providers.
Yeah.
The leading providers in Kazakhstan and in a number of other countries, Belarus, and et cetera. And then after that is in order in this is on my iPad is actually my conclusion. But before I got to my conclusion was the internet kill switch story,
right?
Where I discussed the turning off of the internet in Xinjiang
in 2009,
2009-10 for 10 months, and kind of posed the question, would they ever do it for the country as a whole?
What do you conclude?
And my conclusion is that if they did, it would be an admission of a failure of the entire logic of their system.
Right.
So I don't consider it likely. And then I get into this conclusion where I talk about that logic and talk about Han Han's kind of thoughts on Weibo, which I think have stuck in my mind since he first.
You've actually shared those with us here before. I mean, you'd interviewed him. What year was
I interviewed him a few months after the train crash.
Right.
In 2011.
Right.
And I asked him why he doesn't use Weibo much at all. And at that time, he had maybe tweeted once. And then he got a little bit more active last year.
Weibo at once.
And he said, I got very excited briefly at the time of the Wenzhou train crash. High-speed train crash. People were, everybody was talking about it on Weibo. Everybody was very excited. So I expected that if I went to the window and looked out on the street, there'd be people out in the street. But, I went to the window and looked out and there was no one there. And to take that argument further, he actually, I thought quite intelligently, spun that out a bit more. And he said, people have such a short attention span on microblogs that they kind of just treat it as kind of entertainment, and then for 2 days, even 3 days or a week, and then the next story comes about, and now the previous one is forgotten.
Right, you vented your spleen already on that one,
and he made a comparison to the Sunjagan case.
All right,
in 2003, right. Which is a migrant worker who was beaten to death, and it was and the outrage over that case kind of percolated on the internet for actually weeks and months, and they actually changed a.
Hukou law.
The Hukou law about whether you can be detained if you don't have your papers.
Right.
So that case was he looked at that and he said, look, if Sunjagang beating had happened today, then it would be a story on Weibo for a few days or a week, but it wouldn't necessarily have led to any policy change because people would have just forgotten about it and moved on. And so it's an interesting case looking at whether Weibo does actually have that strong a political impact day to day.
So really, this whole leads you to your real conclusion on this, which is the big question: are we dealing here with a de facto public sphere that is has so empowered the netizenry that it will lead inevitably to democratization in the polity?
Right, and my conclusion is no.
No.
Obviously this is a question that could be answered a million different ways, but my feeling is that it will more likely to extend the current age of authoritarian adaptation of basically the party being forced to do a better job in the short run to maintain power, and the internet is helping them do that. And that's my ultimate conclusion. I don't necessarily argue whether democracy is never going to come to China or not. But I do think that they have shown that you can use the internet to extend your time and power.
So don't you think maybe you're guilty of the Evgeny Morozov overstep?
It's called Evgeny. The Morozov overstep.
The Morozov overstep.
That's going to be the next thing after the Harlem
Shake.
Morozov, one of the books I read, The Net Delusion. He's an author of The Net Delusion, along with, by the way, Rebecca McKinnon's excellent book, Consent of the Network.
Both very great thinkers and, wonderful to read their demolishing of techno-utopians. But don't you think that maybe, I mean, it depends how you define democratization, but maybe you've kind of, instead of just saying, well, it's not going to lead to elections tomorrow, you're almost overstepping the argument and saying, well, in fact, this internet is helping entrenched authoritarianism, whereas in fact there have been many effects that are one could call democratizing.
Right. What would you say? I mean, give me some examples, and then I'll.
Let's just call
PM 2.5 your own example.
Right. You call that democratizing or just
more deliberative, more
being more responsive authoritarians? Right. I mean, I think the thing is you take an issue by issue. And they do what they can, but the fundamental system
isn't.
The fundamentals of the system aren't changing.
That's true, but it's not necessarily empowering them to do more evil.
Oh, I don't
because that's really their goal.
But But I don't even assert that in my piece.
Right. You're creating a straw man.
My piece is not titled "How the Internet Makes China More Evil" or "Makes the Communist Party More Evil." That is not the title of my piece. Nor I think will you find the word "evil" in my entire 12,500 words.
I think it might be instructive for us. Let's talk a little bit about Evgeny Morozov and Rebecca McKinnon, and they've been part of this discourse on the whole, techno-utopian fable. Let's look at how we've talked about the internet. How global intellectuals have talked about the internet since its inception and since it became popular in the mid-90s.
Right.
We started with this real techno-utopianism. We believed that the internet was a special media, that it sort of floated free above the petty concerns of nation-states and such. That it was, that it wanted, it had volition, it wanted to be free. Right.
Right.
And then what happened? I mean, this is sort of the era of that you can't nail the jello to the wall, right?
Right.
And then what happened?
Well,
the Communist Party seemed to have...
China figured out how to nail the jello to the wall.
Really? All along, already by that point, they were trying to figure out how they could do that. Right.
Right.
And I think the Great Firewall, the main centerpiece project of what became known as the Great Firewall began construction in around 2000, 99, 2000. I mean... the father of the Great Firewall was hired in 99 to get that started. The world sort of became aware of it. Remember when Google was blocked entirely in 2000, right. In 2002, right. For about 9 or 10 days. And that was sort of kind of
– That was a turning
That was
point.
A real wake-up call.
Right. I mean, so the people started to realize that there was such a thing, like a concept of internet sovereignty.
And then when it came back without – the ability to look.
I'm sorry,
cash.
Gadi. I have to correct you on that. It started like the very first internet connection I got in 1996. There was a website run out of Canada.
There were blocks from 1996.
Called, like, China.
So
China Digital News or something. I had to get the email newsletter from them because I couldn't get to the
website. I mentioned
the
first attempts at blocks in 1996. Right. It's in the package.
Okay, it's in the package.
What I'm talking about is the kind of sophisticated filtering.
The sophisticated filtering. But the thinking to do this was right from the beginning. Right?
And in fact, this is not in the package. One of the many things I had to leave on the cutting room floor. But in 1995 and 6, there were trips to Singapore by Chinese officials, including... Ding Guanggun,
the propaganda minister,
to study Singapore's way of controlling the internet, even back then. This is covered partly in Daniel Lynch's book, After the Propaganda State, which is really good and really thoughtful on this stuff, even though the internet really wasn't a beast in China yet when he was writing that book.
We should note that you have a terrific bibliography.
Yes.
Right, right. And we'll make sure to put a link to it on the podcast page, but that's a very good list of resources that people should go to.
And someone else who wrote about Singapore as well, who isn't even in the bibliography because I ran out, I just couldn't list every single thing.
Because you ran out of room because it's only the internet.
Because the internet. This scholar, Kalathir, who you just Google Kalathir, listeners, wrote some very interesting papers on this as well. But Singapore was actually China's first model. And so they did start blocking and attempting to block 96, but they didn't get sophisticated about it for a few years after.
So by the mid-2000s, really, I mean, the techno-utopianism had lost some of its shine.
It had, I think, not really, because then the color revolution.
Right, the pendulum swing back to the other side with the color revolution.
And I think in the general
public.
Culminates
with the jasmine stuff, with
I think in the general public consciousness, if you can think think back to when none of us knew anything about any of this stuff. You know, when the internet was coming around and modern communications, you know, when the wall came down before the, you know, the internet in 89, the whole notion of the world of mass communications as what was going to open, you know, to open these societies, mm-hmm. seemed completely just sensible and intuitive, I think, to people who didn't know anything.
Okay.
And most people, you know, aren't experts on these issues.
Right.
And I think that general intuition is still what is held over all those, you know, over all those years in the last decade.
So let's get into it a little bit more. I mean, aside from just sort of brute force censorship, the Chinese Communist Party has exerts influence in other more subtle, interesting ways. To use Michael Anti's very good phrase, I mean, they see it as a battlefield that they want to deploy troops
yes.
onto.
Yes, and Hu Jintao has given speeches on this,
right?
About we need to use the internet. He's talked about it with his Politburo. We need to use the internet as a weapon in the war against hostile foreign forces.
Mm-hmm.
And that started in 2005 is when they started employing, you know, web commentators, mm-hmm. what became known as the 50 Cent Party.
Do you think that's still a useful designation, this whole 50 Cent Party thing? I mean, to me, it has become kind of this broad spectrum pejorative that is applied to anyone who is in the slightest bit defensive about any Communist Party policy, right? I mean,
I think it can be too widely used, right. But there are web commentators throughout
sure.
the country.
Sure, oh yeah, absolutely, they exist.
So they exist, and it's part of a philosophy, central governing philosophy. They exist. Then you have, of course, the monitors at all of the various internet companies throughout China,
mm-hmm.
Doing self-censorship at the various platforms. That's probably the largest kind of human resource component of it.
You talk about Sina having 4,000 of them. Is that
well? No,
that
I'm just saying a study reckons that's possible.
Okay,
That would be if.
But you interviewed Charles at one point when you were still.
Oh, but I interviewed him in 2000. First of all, I interviewed. Sina's never been transparent about how many censors they have. I interviewed Charles in 2011, and when I tried to get the number of censors out of him, he said it was more than 100.
Okay.
At that time, I was already hearing it was 600.
Okay.
When the train crash happened, you know, sources said that they had about 600 that, you know, crashed at the same time to do damage control. And they were lectured to after that. This is also not in the package, but
interesting.
They were given a pretty stern talking to after that.
How is that 4,000 number arrived at, though?
Well, I mean, this is not in the report. I've heard one source. That number in the story is just based on a study reckoning, trying to do math about if it was manual and people were reading every post. But I think they undercounted. They also say that the whatever number they came up with would be reduced by some automation.
Okay.
But almost every report about censorship, the censorship tools done by the censorship tools used by whether it's blogs or microblogs, assumes a lot of manual reading and deleting because mm-hmm. of the way that it's fine-tuned.
Okay.
And it's also very difficult with the Chinese language, as you know. It's not just keywords. It's, you know, there's, you know,
homophones
and right. talking. You
all
know,
sorts of puns. And
exactly. Like so I think 4,000 is quite possible.
Okay.
I mean, if you're counting part-timers.
It also does depend on how you define a censor because
– right.
I mean, I've worked on lots of magazines and websites and things in China that have tried to work within the system. And if you are an editor in China, even at a cutting-edge publication like, say, Cai Xin, the famous Hu Shuli, what your newspaper called the bravest woman in China, the editor's job, part of the job is to decide how daring will you be and
right.
when will you pull back.
Right.
So, I mean, you can – that number is up for debate. Like, do you include the editors – not just the
right.
people whose only job is to censor stuff.
Well, I would invite Weibo to come out with a number,
mm-hmm.
But I don't think that they're about to do that.
No. So what are some of the other interesting ways in which they do manage public opinion? You know, we've now talked about paid commentators. I think maybe we should classify this as part of it as well. There's the way that they utilize the gusto with which this new fifth estate goes after malfeasance on the part of Communist Party officials for mm-hmm. to control the periphery from the center, right?
And right, absolutely. I think the internet is a great tool for the center to kind of put the scare in, put the fright in local officials.
Yeah, and you cite an interesting study that
right. So this is a People's Daily study from a publication of People's Daily from 2010, early days, about a year into Weibo being a force.
It's only gotten worse.
70% of respondents said they believed that local officials suffered from internet terror, which just gave you a sense of how empowered people on the internet felt. And I think if you actually pulled local officials, I wouldn't imagine that you would get far off of that.
No, they're all quaking in there.
Right. Whatever. So it has. I think that's an effect that the center welcomes. and I think that's not the first time that the center has looked for help from kind of other channels for trying to discipline far-flung local officials.
Yeah,
one of the toughest parts of running a one-party government.
And sort of related to that is this whole sort of venting off effect, the pressure release valve effect, right?
Right.
You think that this is also a part of a deliberate policy of allowing people to criticize as long as they don't organize.
Right? Yeah, you can imagine. I mean, it's very difficult to do this sort of counterfactual, but in a society where you weren't able to express grievances and so inequality was growing and pollution and food safety, et cetera, and you were aware, you became aware of these things through other ways, but you weren't able to connect with people and feel that you were able to say something about it. You can imagine that resentment would be perhaps higher in that situation than we have now. It's possible, but it's also very difficult to kind of game that out. But we have to remember that authoritarian governments have fallen long before there was ever an internet. You can't really suggest that it's the internet that would bring about the end of another one.
Well, let's talk a little bit about policy. I mean, if we assume, and I think you rightly do, that a lot of enlightened people who actually look at this problem still have fundamental misunderstandings about the nature of the internet here. If we assume that their assumptions are wrongly informed, they're fundamentally incorrect in some way, has this also led to flawed policy and flawed approaches to affecting change? When well-intentioned parliamentary bodies, say the European, the EU Parliament, or when the U.S. State Department right. undertakes to liberate the internet in China, are they going about it wrong?
Boy, that's a broader question about engaging China generally. I mean, I think there's a lot of disagreement about how to engage China. I mean, you cannot separate out, I don't think, the internet from the rest of the foreign policy, the policy portfolio with China. I mean, the human rights portfolio or the commerce portfolio.
No, I'm sorry. I think you can. I mean, look, the United States, for all its, evil things it does around the world, I mean, you built the internet, right? If there was no the military actually built the internet, and the internet is a gift from the United States to the rest of the world. So what you can do as the United States is just build more internet, give us more pipes, make free server space available, hosted in Alaska or Texas. Just give the stuff to the rest of the world. That's what you can do. No,
yeah, kind of agree with you there, Jeremy. I mean, my when asked about,
I thought you were talking about engagement with China, but if you're talking about
No, I'm not talking about engagement.
Building an internet that's more available, that's certainly something that can be done.
Right. Rather than, say, building circumvention technologies, things like that, which I think are wrong. I mean, when I've been critical in the past about the State Department's approach, focusing on what I think is a fairly small part of the problem, this, the great firewall part of the equation, and people ask, well, so what would you do with that money? The 50 million or whatever was earmarked. I said, I think that the great champions of the people who have contributed the most to the growth of the public sphere, to the growth of this other half of the equation that stands sort of in opposition to, the adoptive authoritarians who have, the adaptive, what are we calling it?
Adoptive authoritarians would be something right. very different.
Right. So that's the next phase.
What I'm saying is, I think that
I'm an adoptive authoritarian.
Adoptive authoritarian. What I would say is if you look at all these companies, right, all the major Chinese internet companies have something in common. Most of them were funded by American venture capital.
Right.
So, I mean, throw the money there. I mean, build more. I mean, build the public sphere out by, you know, putting money into interesting, disruptive internet companies.
But is that something that should be a centrally directed policy choice, or is that something that the private sector should be? Well, I mean,
one thing they could do is just not hurt these companies who face the possibility of delisting in America because of some.
Have you got any personal interest in this
matter? Holding Baidu stock options.
Anything you'd like to disclose? Not options,
I'll stop now before I get in trouble.
Well, actually, you're getting at a couple topics. I think this is another thing that was on the cutting room floor. I wanted to get a little bit more into how it's really a foreign-owned internet in China. I mean, all these companies, as you said, are heavily invested by mostly Americans, but not all entirely Americans. Yeah, South Africans as well.
Too. With so everyone Tencent. In this room here.
So that was one thing. And another thing that's on the cutting room floor that I thought would have been fun to do.
It would have been. I mean, I remember you came to Baidu at one point, the fifth anniversary of our IPO. And one of the questions that you asked Rob, I think it was you. He said, you know, why are all the listed internet companies, I mean, why is the state not in charge of the commanding heights of the internet here? I mean, why do we not see big state-owned internet companies? Was that you that asked that?
That may have been me. I mean, it was a round table. We were all asking Robin questions.
I thought it was a really good question. And I think Robin's answer was that they just didn't react fast enough. They didn't
I think
see
that's correct. I think if they built the internet today, the internet industry today would look...
The commanding heights would be occupied by state-owned companies.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely think so.
And so another one that was on the cutting room floor while we're on that topic that might be of interest is I would have loved to have kind of done a little bit more of an anatomy of what who makes the decisions and how fast when something big happens that they decide they want to shut down on Weibo and then or events they decide not to shut down. Right. So like for instance the flight of Wang Lijun to the consulate in Chengdu there was tons of Weibo after that and you could say it was an indication that Bo Xilai was not being protected.
Right.
It seems that that may have been the case.
We're all in that business.
And meanwhile, when Ling Jihua, who might have been the guy who makes those kinds of decisions, he works in the office of worked in the office of Hu Jintao in the general office. When his son apparently died in a
Ferrari
crash last year.
Balfour Zhichao, yeah.
That did disappear immediately.
It disappeared from the social media.
From social media.
It was actually still searchable on Baidu, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. It would have been interesting to do that, but it was perhaps a bridge too far for this report. But anyways, there's endless topics of, I think, fascination on the way that China does its internet.
So, I mean, some years ago, there was an internet researcher by the name of Lachman Tse, who now works for Google. He described the Great Firewall in the minds of many people as kind of an Iron Curtain 2.0. That is, it had come to stand for the dividing line between an information-suppressed East and a relatively free West. Do you think that there's, first of all, something to that? And do you think that perception warps our ideas about the Chinese internet in liberal West that we tend to see it as not as truly dynamic as it is, in fact?
Right. I think I would agree with where your leading question is going.
You two perfectly good options.
No, but I mean, I think, phrases like, you know, Iron Curtain 2.0 or whatever make it all about this sort of kind of Cold War mentality.
Right.
And the China of today is very different from the Soviet Union that was behind the Iron Curtain. I mean, it's by design.
Yeah.
And I think it would be it might give people a little bit of a misleading sense. You know, when I talk to like young groups of students that come over here, and one of the questions I usually ask them is like, what is their impressions of China? And some of these, this kind of Cold War mentality comes through in a lot of the answers. I mean, in addition to some of the new stuff that's coming through about, you know, there is wealth in China in addition to the poverty that they think is here.
Great infrastructure.
But I think some of that is due to that sort of, you know, Cold War terminology.
Right. Well, great. Before too much of this ends up on the cutting room floor, let's wrap. That was great, man. I really – this is – I highly recommend anyone – you get a chance to read all through.
Thank you. If you didn't fall asleep while I was narrating the special report earlier, you don't fast forward it to the end. Reading it for yourself, you might actually enjoy.
And let's jump now into recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you start us off with recommendations this week? What do you have for us?
I have a book which you can get on Kindle if you live in China, and in bookstores if you don't, maybe. And it's basically comes out of the China Dialogue site, which is about the environment in China. Isabel Hilton's site, and the editor of the site, Sam Gill, the editor of this book, and Isabel Hilton wrote the introduction. It's called China and the Environment, the Green Revolution. And it's basically about a number of environmental topics, the rise of civil society in China, particularly with regards to the environment. Short book.
Really connecting it to our topic today. Yeah.
Right. I thought it was a great book. I've read most of it. And Jonathan Ansfield has a terrific chapter in there about the Xiamen PX plant. Right.
Which we've talked about on this
protest. It's a terrific, it's like a 70-page chapter. It's kind of the centerpiece of the book to me. And it's really terrific reporting. And I do highly recommend that book as well.
Well, thanks. I'll put it on my list.
There we go.
A double recommend.
I will just recommend a non-China book because it happens to be the one I'm reading right now as I finished my binge of reading internet books and papers, which I would encourage you to look at the sources link on the internet report to find some of those. But The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone by Dan Ariely, it's a very interesting book about, you know, he does these kind of studies of, you know, why are people dishonest in different situations and what makes us that way.
Thank God we can be, though.
Right. He doesn't argue that you shouldn't be.
Right.
But one of the interesting ones that I think is sort of China related is they did a study of whether you're more dishonest when you are using counterfeit products or like wearing like
–
Yeah. In other words, does wearing fake sunglasses, fake, you know, designer sunglasses make you more dishonest than when you wear, you know, real designer sunglasses?
Okay, cut to the chase. What was the answer?
Yes,
you are. Yeah, I would have thought so intuitively.
I thought it was very a very interesting conclusion.
But anyways, there's control for, you know, you're the kind of prick who wears fake shit anyway. I mean,
I don't think they did the Kaiser Kuo control.
I would have done that, man. I would have done that. Okay, I'm going to recommend something totally unrelated to China. But it's just been an obsession of mine recently. Tim Minchin. Tim Minchin is an Australian. He's from Perth and lives in the UK now. He's a consummate musician. He's a terrific musician. And he's a skeptic in sort of the new atheist tradition.
Your tradition.
Yeah, it's a tradition. Yeah. It's a
tradition.
He's just hysterical, very musically talented, and his lyrics are just irreverent and funny as fuck. And I love the guy. He's a wonderful performer, and also deeply moving.
Name the specific thing that you're recommending?
Tim, the collected works of Tim Minchin. Look him up on YouTube.
I think you should name that the animation you showed me first.
Yeah. Okay. One. Yeah. That it's called Storm. Just look up Storm. Tim Minchin. Minchin. Storm, the animated movie. It's just a little 9-minute short. It's,
and you can go and find that on the internet. Although you might need a VPN.
Right.
And I also China.
So that's my recommendation. He's actually, there's a New Yorker article. It's paywalled, unfortunately, and you can't VPN around that. Although you can ask Evan Osnos to send you the piece. Anyway,
I subscribe to the New Yorker, but you know what? You need to get. You need to have a VPN to download the New Yorker to your iPad.
You do.
In China.
That's Evan's fault. But anyway,
you can get free stuff on like BitTorrent that you don't even need a VPN for if you want to.
If you want to be dishonest and use pirated stuff.
When you're BitTorrenting, are you more dishonest?
You know, Jeremy, I never really trusted you. Never really trusted you.
Anyway.
I don't know any fake stuff.
Okay, so the New Yorker article is basically about him doing the Roald Dahl, wonderful Roald Dahl book, Matilda. He's done a musical on it that's showing in London right now.
I'm really anxious
to see that. Anyway, so that's our show. And that's a wrap. And God,
thank you, guys.
Thanks for coming, man.
It was a lot of fun.
All right. And Jeremy, as always, and I know we promised something on healthcare. That is in the
It's
in
coming.
The
it's coming. Coming. It's coming. Very it's soon. Coming. Next week, I think.
And we've also got upcoming the author of Do Not Get Married Before You're 30, Ms. Joy Chen, who is a leading happy feminist here in China. And we're going to be talking to her about women's issues. So thanks, folks. We'll see you next week. Take care.